Primary Reaction Chamber.
We're Copper Raymond on.
Time.
Initial reaction at T-minus 30.
Fuel slug in place.
Stand by for injection.
Capsule breach now.
Reaction commencing.
Containment field hold to 3.14 meters of tar. Initial dangers crossing to capacity.
Can we hold it?
What's happening?
Critical mass.
Hold on!
Mind spike!
You're listening to Critical Mass Podcast. My name is Winston Crutchfield. I'm your host. We've got a few things to talk about with you today, including the subject of modern crime dramas as instigated by the new show Castle, starring Nathan Fillion on ABC Network, and a review of a new RPG I picked up, well, new to me anyway, Savage Worlds, which I picked up at Fear the Con, and I called for help on this one. I inherited my love of detective stories and action shows from my father, so I thought it the best thing I could do would be to get him on the phone and get a better perspective of television crime dramas through the years. So in just a second, we're going to launch right into that. But first, let's hear a little bit about this.
Water. We drink it. We bathe in it. We wash our clothes in it. We need it to grow crops. We take it for granted, yet for 1.1 billion people in the world, clean water is a luxury. Unclean water threatens the lives of billions of people every day, but most of us listening to this don't know what life without clean water would be like. Something as simple as a public water fountain is an oddity to many people. We buy clean water in a bottle for $1, and that same dollar could give a person clean water for an entire year. I'm John Wilkerson, host of the Jesus Geek Podcast. Will you join me in raising funds to provide clean water to people who desperately need it? Please visit water.jesusgeek.info for more information on how you can change someone's life with just $1 a day. That's water.jesusgeek.info. Give water and give life.
Well, let me think for a minute. While you're thinking about where we were, you're wanting to know about crime dramas on television, and yet you start off with those in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, and I don't know how they are going to relate to whatever it is you're doing in the year 2000. Well, so you got any ideas there?
Well, I think it's important to understand where something has come from in order to, to understand where it's at today. And with something like serial television, there is a fairly dramatic shift in what was considered the sitcoms of the 70s and the sitcoms of the 50s. And the sitcoms of the 90s. In fact, you pick if you just pick a situational comedy from any just from randomly out of the library, a chance viewing will tell you during what period of television it was produced. I mean, when you turn on The Cosby Show, it's obviously a a 1980s kind of show, and Happy Days, for all of its let's glamorize the 50s, was obviously produced during the 70s.
Yeah.
The same the same shows, and it's not just it's not just sitcoms. It's just, I think sitcoms are the ones that show it most obviously, because those are the ones with the greatest amount of pop culture reference. Nobody is going to mistake an episode of Friends or Seinfeld for something that was on during the 80s or during the 60s or anything else.
Right.
So, I was wondering if a if we can track a similar evolution in the nature of crime dramas. And I'm on crime drama right now because I just watched the second episode of Castle last night with Nathan Fillion.
Okay.
And I was really impressed by Castle. I also noticed something in it that differentiated it from other shows of its kind that are on that are on TV right now. And probably the most noticeable of those are the twin juggernauts of police drama right now are still Law and Order and CSI.
But then we've got Bones.
Bones. Oh, I hadn't thought about Bones. I don't. That's not one of the ones I watch. I was not impressed with either the police work or the acting on that show. Because I got to tell you, as likable as David Boreanaz is, and as much as I appreciate him in that role, the way that they do things on the show, the science that with a capital S ending quotes that they try to use on that show just really kind of turned me off. It's what finally drove me away from CSI. You know what? There are two things that drove me away from CSI. First and primarily, they started using very loose interpretations of the scientific procedures that run the show. And you know what? For a police procedural, that's just not a good sign. And at the beginning of the series, they made an attempt to keep to keep the science relatively accurate, while the crime lab wasn't run anything like a real crime lab was run, because that wouldn't be dramatic. But
right.
But at least they tried to keep the science in check. And lately they haven't been doing that. And the other thing that CSI did that has just killed the show for me. They started focusing instead of the mystery, instead of focusing on solving the mystery or getting the criminal, they started focusing on the personal lives of the characters involved in the show. And at that point,
right,
I just kind of mentally checked out. It's a procedural. It's not you really ought to be able to plug any halfway decent actor into those roles and have a successful show. That's what kept Law and Order on the air for so long. And it's what's keeping it on the air for so long. And it's the same thing that's kept ER on the air for so long. The strength of the show, the strength of the story doesn't come from the strength of the characters. It doesn't come from these characters being dramatic and sensitive and sympathetic and whatnot. It comes from the strength of the stories and the fact that they are able to tell engaging and involving stories. Anyway, that's a... sorry, I didn't mean to go off like that, but it's a pet
just
peeve.
Just listen to Winston. Listen to yourself.
Okay, I'm listening.
Oh, what you've just done is to give a I don't remember the word. Something that sounds like synopsis of a particular show. It's be a synopsis for a generation of shows. Those that focus on people, like Perry Mason, like Columbo. I can't think of Mannix, Magnum, Mike Hammer. That focus on people. If they don't also bring in enough reality to give the people a taste of it, then they don't usually last too long. And if they bring in way too much reality, then they get kicked off the air because people can't tolerate the stupidity of it. You know, so what you've done is to identify what you're looking for in crime dramas. Why was Dragnet so successful? Name is Joe Friday. That's why he was successful. Okay?
That's true.
It's exactly why it was successful. Because when Frank Smith died off, they brought in somebody else. When he died off, they brought in somebody else. You know, it's the main character of Dragnet is what kept the attention of the country. You know, because this character, what did he do? He told the story in words. You know, he told it in words with only supporting pictures or film, as you would, you know.
Sure.
Columbo and Perry Mason did very much the same. They told the story in words with supporting graphics. And Mannix, on the other hand, and Magnum, they and Mike Hammer, they told the story as an action hero type thing. And they didn't do a good job for whatever reason. I don't know. But they didn't do a good job. But it was an action show. But it told a story, and you had to be fast to catch it because they didn't stop and wait on you.
Where, you know what? I'm going to guess that the spiritual successor to these shows right now is going to be shows like Monk with Tony Shalhoub or Psych. And I can't remember the name of the kid who plays on Psych. What drew Castle to my attention was the fact that, and you know what? He reminded me of Columbo. I think that's why I thought of you. He reminded me of Columbo. I don't know. There was something about the show that reminded me of an earlier era of crime drama, and I was hoping you would have a better perspective on that.
Well, I haven't seen Castle. I don't know, but I think I've about decided, or decided? No. That's the wrong word. Whatever. I have delineated what I thought was the strength of the 50s, 60s, and 70s crime dramas.
Okay.
And the ones that I probably know best, which is Ironside, Perry Mason, Columbo, Dragnet, and Mike Hammer, and things like this. Everything was pointed on, was played on a character and supported by everybody else and everything else.
Okay.
And you're saying that this Castle has come full circle to that.
You know, I think that's what I have been trying to get to with it. Of course, I haven't been able to express it quite as clearly, but
things like the 18, that's a crime drama.
Now, see, you know what? I would not have called the A-Team a crime drama. I would put the A-Team in the same category as shows like The Incredible Hulk or The Pretender or Knight Rider. It's not a coincidence that most of those shows were done by Donald Belisario, you know, where you have the lone hero riding into a situation and he solves it for somebody and then rides off into the sunset. I wouldn't have thought of those as crime dramas. Magnum P.I. was much the same way as the A-Team was.
Right. But see, the whole point of having Magnum P.I., Mannix, and the A-Team was to solve a problem. And it almost always involved some type of crime against humanity, whether it was murder or what are the other things besides homicide. There's got to be something.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing the A-Team would do with, wouldn't it? Or Jared from The Pretender, or
yeah, especially The Pretender. He was one that was always setting things right. Now Quantum Leap, I would take a leap just to consider them a crime drama, but you're going to have to differentiate what you're looking for more specifically than crime drama, probably. You'll probably want to make a new category or something for it. I don't know what it'd be, but the crime in the 50s was open and in your face. And in the 60s, it began to get seductive and what's the other word to try to fool you? I can't remember. But anyway, in the 70s and the 80s, it got to be blatant and open, fueled by the Godfather type of operation. And HBO did the whole Godfather thing with The Sopranos. I'm sure there's lots of others. I'm just not remembering everything. But in the 90s and the 2000s, it's a computer generation in your face type of thing. It's a cross between crime and Last Action Hero type deal. So what were we talking about? Crime dramas. And before I got carried away.
That's okay. It started off as I was really impressed by Castle, the first two episodes of Castle. And I had identified something in there that I thought was unique and interesting, and I wanted to get a better perspective on it from you. And I think we have about beat that to death.
Okay. Well, I have a question, though.
Sure.
I have never seen Castle.
Well, it's only
how do they tell the story?
Get on Hulu and catch up.
Yeah, right.
How do they in all your spare time. How do they tell the story?
How do they tell the story? It's the story that interests me.
You know what? Coincidentally, it's the story that interests Castle, too. That's why he is doing this. The character of Rick Castle is a thriller novelist. And he has attached himself to the NYPD in order to get inspiration for his next series of novels. So the story is told in a very straightforward manner so far. I mean, they apply basic dragnet style police work, and then they eventually track down the perpetrator. And in the middle of it all, you get the interaction between the two of them. I think what I really like about it is Castle and his insight into human nature. I just watched this last episode like last night, so it's kind of fresh. And in the episode, they are examining potential suspects in the murder case and in this building. They're like, well, let's talk to the janitors who would have access to that stairwell in this building. And he's like, well, what about the guy in 8B? And, you know, everybody stops. They're like, why should we talk to the guy in 8B? You know, the guy in 8B has been watching the victim, and, you know, it starts real small at first. You know, he writes her little notes, he has little fantasies, and eventually it escalates for him until he finally confronts her and she brushes him off, and he tries again, and there's a second chance, and then there's an accident, something happened, and he winds up killing her accidentally. And of course you've got Nathan Fillion just delivering exceptionally well-scripted dialogue, and not me stumbling through a summary of the
right
of the events.
Well,
but you know, at the end of it, you know,
Castle is telling the story right along as he goes, very much like Columbo.
Very
only
much
telling
like
parts
Columbo
of the story,
kind of like Columbo. You know, telling the way that things would have happened if he was doing it, because he's constantly telling them, and it's like, well, yeah, that could happen, but if they did it that way, it's not a very good story. It's a much better story if this and this and this happened. And sometimes he's right, sometimes he's not. Yeah, he's kind of like a Columbo meets Jessica Drew, and his partner his partner is very Jack Webb. So,
well, it sounds like an interesting show.
It is an interesting show. I enjoyed it quite a lot. And
It comes on Monday. Monday's at 10 o'clock. Well, there's a possibility I could get to see it.
Well, I have inherited my love for detective stories from you. I am quite certain. So I guess that's why I immediately thought of you when it turned out I enjoyed this as much as I have.
I appreciate the thing. Thinking of, probably a thought would be better, well, but thinking of is pretty good.
Well, Daddy, it is 20 past 2 by my clock, which means it is time for me to go down to the bus stop and make sure that my own darling daughter is getting off the bus safe and sound.
Okay, we shall talk to you another time.
In 2005, a crack podcasting unit was sent to prison by a kangaroo court for a crime they didn't commit. These squirrels promptly escaped from a maximum security treehouse to the Texas underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as podcasters of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A-Team.
TubeLongSquirrels.com is better than pie.
So while I was at Fear the Con, I signed up for a game called Savage Mega Man. We were promised the opportunity to play the evil robotic creations of Dr. Wily and attempt to destroy the Blue Bomber, Mega Man himself. And this was to use the Savage Worlds game system. Now, I'm not familiar with the Savage Worlds game system, but I know it's been around a while, and I've heard lots of good things about it. It's just not one that I've ever picked up before. So while I was at the con, I went ahead and picked one up from the vendor in the back room. And I must say, I was immediately impressed. The physical design of the book, it's called, the one I picked up was the Savage Worlds Explorers Edition, which is a 6x9 perfect bound copy. It is full color, glossy pages, beautifully painted throughout, and has a pulp action feel to both the rules and to the artwork inside. There's a huge number of game systems, both licensed game systems and fan game systems that use this setting. And when I turned it over to read a little bit about it, I discovered that the cover price on the book is only $10. You know, at this point, I really don't have an excuse for not adding this to my collection of gaming material. So I bought the Savage Worlds game. I got a little flavor for the rules at the Savage Mega Man session that afternoon. Had a lot of fun. Wound up nuking the Earth, although we somehow missed Mega Man himself. Well, you know, these things happen. Took it home and read through. Now, something important to understand about this $10 rule book is that it is just the rules. Now, it's a very beautiful rule book, but there is no setting material because it is designed to let you use this set of rules in your own setting, much the same way that GURPS is. However, where GURPS has a very realistic feel to it, the feel to the rules of Savage Worlds is fast, furious, and fun is their slogan for that, and that's really what they focus on. So you get a kind of high action rule set that is slim and trim and requires very little bookkeeping, and I appreciated all of that. Perhaps my favorite thing about the rules themselves is the fact that they use five of the six polyhedral dice in your standard gaming set. So D4 through D12 are all used for attributes and skills, while the D20 is used mainly to roll on charts. What this means, among other things, is that there's only 4 degrees of separation between levels of talent before you get into mods and adds and modifiers and what have you, which doesn't lead to a very crunchy rule system. This is not a simulation of reality. This isn't even really a tactical simulation. In fact, when you're thinking tabletop role-playing game and you've got Savage Worlds in hand, best to get your mind off of the simulation category entirely. This is not even as detailed as the D20 system is, nor yet anything close to GURPS. This is designed primarily to let you chuck some dice and have fun. So with that in mind, some friends and I broke out the dice and pen and paper and started made up some characters and ran through a short scenario. We quickly discovered that the Savage Worlds rule system is highly dependent upon the tabletop. And I don't just mean being there to throw your dice on. You need a grid and you need miniatures if you're going to play this game right. Well, I guess you can actually do it without the grid, but you know what? Miniatures come in very, very helpful. Now, for a group of modern gamers who have been raised on D20 under the Wizards of the Coast marketing machine, where they are sold minis right along with the rule books, this is not really a hurdle. This is probably just something that they expect. But for old-school gamers like myself and my gaming group, this felt more like a game of Warhammer Skirmish than it did a role-playing game. And, of course, for our scenario, we just had a couple characters. I plucked the zombie from the bestiary in the back of the book, and the guys ran through town killing zombies for a little bit. Actually, our first outing on the game, we spent an hour and a half, and it took two characters an hour and a half to kill about 8 zombies. I don't attribute that to any deficiency in the rules as much as to our, you know, being the first time that we've really done anything with the system. Now that we're familiar with it, I expect that future games will go much more quickly. And in fact, we're getting together next week to stomp on the Zombie Master and his homunculus. Having said that, the rules don't really support much other than a tabletop battle. The magic and superpowers system included in the book is bare bones. They really depend on you to either flesh that out yourself or to buy one of the campaign settings to flesh those out. And the non-violent NPC interaction is really kind of limited to a reaction chart, where you can use one or two skills to vary the hostility level of an NPC towards you, all the way from downright hostile to fawningly agreeable. The supernatural fear element of the game also lacks a bit. There is a single rule for fear and a single fear chart to roll on should you pass or fail your fear effect rolls, but there's not really anything in the rules to support the kind of brooding horror that you would get from a GURPS horror game or from the World of Darkness books. In fact, as it goes, this game reminds me much more of the Palladium system than any of the others, in that it is designed primarily for tactical tabletop combat and just kind of leaves skills and personal interaction to the imagination of the players and the GM. I don't really count this as a deficiency. It tends to suit my style of play, and that's just fine. But I did find that as far as the tabletop simulation goes, when we finally got the hang of it, the rules played wonderfully. Savage Worlds, I endorse it. It is FTB 9000 compliant. The guys at Fear the Boot endorse it. And no, I'm not getting any kind of kickback from Pinnacle Publishing. But what I am going to be doing, after investigating the license on the Pinnacle website, I am going to be putting the Atomic Earth game. I had been intending to use a D20 open gaming license to provide Atomic Earth setting material for your own role-playing campaigns on the website. But having investigated the Pinnacle license over at their website, I think I'm going to go with Savage Worlds instead, as this suits much more the flavor and the style of play that I'm looking for with Atomic Earth. This is not the board game. You will, of course, you'll be able to read and enjoy the setting material online as it gets posted along with your copy of the board game. But then, let's face it, there are lots more adventures out there than just gathering shards and bringing them home to keep your city safe, right? There's a whole world full of giant atomic monsters on the loose, and you've got to have some way to explore it. Well, Savage Worlds is going to be my vehicle of choice. So look for their logo on the Critical Press website shortly, and look for background material and history and cool artwork and stuff to start appearing in short order. In the meantime, the rulebook is $10. You can get a copy through Critical Press Amazon, again, right through the website. Check it out. I'm really enjoying it. I'm looking forward to producing stuff along with the Pinnacle Entertainment Group. And they're very, very fan-friendly license as well as a very developer-friendly license, I might add. So check it out. Pick you up a couple of pick you out some copies of stuff through the through my website and or your local friendly gaming store. There you have it. In the meantime, I'd sure appreciate it if you would leave a comment on the blog. Let me know what you think of the show. If you're enjoying it, if you're not enjoying it, what you'd like to see more of, what you'd like to see less of. Or you can email me at mindspike@criticalpressmedia.com or send me an MP3 of you saying something witty and clever, and I'll play it on the show. In the meantime, since you've heard a promo both for John Wilkerson's show and his cause Podcasting for Water, and a promo for the Two Blind Squirrels, the A-Team of Podcasting, thought I'd give you a little closeout with a little flavor of what happens when you put them both in the same microphone.
Hey, Brad, it's John, and I just wanted to submit my entry for the little ending thingy that you have there.
Oh,
with,
no.
Because I've really been thinking about it, and I think I have something that'll be just right. If you want me to re-record it, I'll re-record it.
Oh, brother.
But it goes, something like this.
Okay.
You need to accept the Lord, because if you don't, you're going to go to hell with a warm diet of matzah, and the fire of the hell cannot be quenched. They're going to burn you up for all eternity. Yes. So come to the Lord and accept the quenching water of his word in your life.
Preach it, brother.
Because it's the only thing.
Woo! Preach it, brother.
The fire of the hell.
Oh.
Yeah, so I thought you might like that. Whew. That was kind of my first experience with somebody presenting the gospel to me.
Oh, Lord.
At Southern Baptist Church in Texas.
Yes.
And while he didn't exactly use that exact words, but, you know, imagine a big, fat, red-faced, sweating, spitting Southern Baptist preacher in a suit that's soaked, got the armpit sweat underneath, up on stage trying to convince me to come to the Lord.
Was his, name Dr. Redman?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Anyway, that's my submission. I like it.
Thank you, John.
Nice.
That's good. I like that.
I do like that.
I like that.
I may actually use that.
Mm-hmm.
That
no, I might.